Welcome to the podcast series of the Warwick Commission on the Future of Cultural Value. Today I'm going to be talking to Sir Peter Bazalgette, who is Chair of Arts Council of England and also one of the commissioners on the Warwick Commission. So Sir Peter, just to begin, perhaps you could tell us a little bit why you were attracted to the Warwick Commission or wanted to be involved with it.
There's a very specific, perhaps rather political reason in the short term, which is that we have a general election in the United Kingdom in May 2015. And I think it's really important for the different political parties to have as many policy ideas relating to arts and culture, which I regard as absolutely fundamental to quality of life in Britain, success of the country and everything else, to have as many policy ideas as possible. And so the Warwick Commission, I hope, is going to be the source of some really good policy ideas around pushing and encouraging and enhancing our arts and culture offer.
So, as a first question then, what does culture mean to you and why do you think it's so important that we invest in culture?
So, culture is a very broad word, and of course in its broadest it means just a sort of way of life, but using the word culture in relation to arts, arts and culture, what is our culture? And for me it's about our quality of life, it's about our sense of identity, it's about our sense as a nation, as a country, it's about how we see ourselves therefore, but also how the world sees us. And actually Britain's culture is probably one of the things that it's best known for in the world, gives it influence. And it's about developing what I think of as an empathetic citizenry. It's individuals who will be full members of society, who understand the interests, concerns and predicaments of their fellow citizens. So it's all of those things. So culture is critical for all the reasons I've just said. And I strongly believe in the importance of public support for it. And when I say public support, that might mean investment in arts and culture via public funding, via the lottery, via taxation, from trusts and foundations, from wealthy individuals or from businesses. All of those are different constituencies that can support and should support the arts, and it's really important that they do.
So for the last few years, what's been kind of driving important decisions about how to invest in the arts is this term of cultural value. In what kind of terms specifically do you think that cultural value should be articulated in public discussions of the arts?
Since I've become chair of Arts Council England about almost a year ago, I talked to lots of politicians and lots of civil servants and lots of people in the public arena. And I found that nearly everybody's in favour of public support for arts and culture, but an awful lot of people have forgotten why we do it. And I think it's really important, therefore, to explore and define what cultural value is. What is the public good that is delivered via arts and culture? And for me, it comes under four main headings. One is the intrinsic value of culture, which I spoke about earlier. Quality of life, the empathetic citizen, how we see ourselves, how the world sees us, and so on. Then there's the way culture aids society, and it doesn't matter whether you're talking about the way in which older people who may be lonely or isolated get benefit from arts performances, or whether it's the way in which arts and culture works in prisons, or whether it connects with health and well-being. These are all ways in which arts and culture benefits society. Then a special heading of its own would be education, the symbiotic relationship between arts, culture and education at primary and secondary levels, at higher education and continuing lifelong learning. And then lastly and fourthly, the economic benefits of investing in arts and culture. It's become quite clear over the last 10 years that arts institutions have an incredibly important role in regional regeneration. There are all sorts of cities across the country where arts has gone first in regenerating not just the local economy and clusters of creative businesses and creative talent, but also how people feel about themselves locally, what the quality of life is. So regional regeneration, it's part of the tourist offer for a location. It develops talent that feeds into the creative industries and will go forward and create economic value in the future. And lastly, the way in which we export our arts and culture, it leads to how what Britain's reputation in the world is, what its influence is, whether people will trade with us. There's interesting British Council research that shows that people who come into contact with British culture are more likely to trade with Britain. So that's, if you like, a holistic picture of what cultural value is. intrinsic value of culture, society, education, and economic benefits. And it's important we see the whole picture and get people to understand the whole picture.
So, kind of building on what you said just there, obviously a very fundamental aspect of the debate on cultural value and how we invest in culture is going to take a financial aspect to it. But cultural value in itself as a term has historically been trying to step away from, and if you want, dislocate instrumental or financial notions or profit-driven notions of why we should invest in culture. But it seems that that has been a bit of a struggle in a lot of the kind of work which I've seen on cultural value in the last decade. Do you think it's actually possible to get rid of or to kind of transcend those?
It's a false dichotomy to say you should dissociate the instrumentalist from the, if you like, philosophical.
Yeah.
What's critical is the way you talk about it and the way you present it. And for me, when you're talking about the holistic analysis, if you like, of cultural value, for me, what's critical is you talk about the intrinsic value of culture first. Mm. It's critical. It sits at the core. Our quality of life, our sense of self, our behaviour as citizens, these are all critical parts of our culture. It's not something you can reduce to numbers. And these are just things you believe in as an act of faith and, if you like, as a philosophical commitment. And if you talk about economic benefits of arts before you talk about the intrinsic value of culture, you sound like somebody who knows the price of everything and the value of nothing.
Yeah.
And that's the danger. And the way around that danger is not to obviate economic benefits, because they're there, but it's to talk about the intrinsic value of culture first.
Yeah, and I suppose that taking this approach of understanding the kind of the holistic nature of cultural value, or this ecosystem approach to culture, is hopefully going to be a good way of doing exactly that. One of the biggest problems in the cultural value debate is that of access. Some evidence has recently suggested that the arts are valued most by those who are already invested or already go about investing in them through tickets and things like that. Whereas those who don't invest in the arts at all view them simply as a disposable luxury. How do you think we could articulate the importance of culture and cultural value to those who decide deliberately not to invest in them? And is it possible to make a case for value per se that kind of transcends individual taste, preference and cultural habit?
In terms of access, the first question is which arts and which culture? Are we talking about a performance of Shakespeare on the stage of the Royal Shakespeare Company in Stratford? Or are we talking about a music video on YouTube? Or are we talking about a reality show on Channel 4?
Mm-hmm.
These are all parts of our, with a small c, culture. And it's a mistake to think of arts and culture as some strange thing the government puts money into and nothing else is cultural or artistic or comes under the heading of what our national culture is.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in fact, our culture belongs to everybody. Access to it is almost a meaningless statement, because everybody is part of it. You're already in it. You can't back out of it. You can't resign from your national culture. That would be the first point. But then if you're going to take a narrower definition of the arts and culture and look at, you know, organised arts, as in the visual arts, the performing arts, and literature, and so on, then it's surely the point that every child must have access to that art and that culture.
Mm-hmm.
But when, as adults, if they choose not to access it, if they choose not to go to it, that's their choice. That's fine. I mean, it's up to them. What are they interested in? What do they want to do? Successful arts and culture should attract a wide audience. It should work very hard to include people. It should be inclusive, but it won't get everybody. The critical thing is it made available, is the opportunity to access it made available to every school child? And I think an awful lot of arts and culture institutions that are seen as quite highfalutin or narrow in their appeal are actually much broader in their appeal than people think, because they have education outreach programs people don't take into account. And I have watched school pupils sitting in the middle of an orchestra being sung Mozart opera and being picked up and carried around the room and chortling with joy and thinking that opera was the greatest thing it had ever come to. Nobody told them you had to wear a black tie and it was not for them. I've seen, Shakespeare in schools, a fantastic project. So that's the next point. The third thing would be geographical, that we need to harness digital technology to make arts and culture much more available to more people in more places than was ever possible before. And we're just at the beginning of that process. We need to imagine how that's going to be done. There are good examples, but we're just at the start of what you might call is the digital millennium. And the last point about access is capacity, that unless you work very hard to develop real skills and great arts institutions. You can't put money into a place that has no arts institutions. And that's why things like what the Arts Council does, it has a lottery-funded project called Creative People and Places, which is specifically targeting money at areas of low arts take-up, which is saying, well, how can we get better arts institutions and creative people supported creating great arts institutions in this place, which then develop the whole infrastructure of talent and then the appeal to the local populace. So those are all different takes on access. It's quite complex, and it's not as simple as some people say.
So Arts Council England has recently published a renewed strategy for the next 7 years. How do you see the UK's funding environment changing over the coming decade? And how difficult is it to plan within a sector or within a society more broadly that's facing such a constant change?
It's going to be bloody tough over the next 7 years, because whichever government is in power, they are going to try to reduce the share of government expenditure as a percentage of overall national output. But the arts are going to be brilliant. We arguably lead the world in our arts and culture. London is seen as the capital of arts and culture. We have astonishing arts institutions around the country. And so I am very optimistic, notwithstanding the very tough challenges. Now, it is quite clear that arts and culture has got to be cleverer at diversifying its revenue streams. We want to persuade the government of whatever hue that it is a proper subject for public investment and that it yields benefits, and we talked about that earlier. But it isn't going to suddenly be transformed or get much, much better in the way that it did when the lottery was brought in the early 90s. That made a big difference. And the way that the Labour government of 97 to 2010 gave above inflation rises to arts funding. We're not going back to those two. The Conservatives brought in the lottery, Labour increased the funding. They both did a lot for the arts in that era. We're not going back to that. So diversifying revenue streams, encouraging better fundraising, getting corporate Britain, companies, back into supporting the arts, new forms of funding via social investment and social enterprise models is going to be important as well. And, of course, the other great concern is local authorities, who are cutting strongly their funding of the arts, and yet the quality of life of their local community depends on good arts. So that's another problem we have to tackle.
So do you think it would be worth, when dealing with problems of investment in the arts or diversifying the modes of investment in the arts, do you think it would be worth comparing the UK with other international models? And I mean, from the way you speak, I thought automatically of the States, because in America they have a much more diverse model already, so I wonder if it might be useful to compare in international cases.
We can always learn from how people do things abroad, and certainly arts organisations are better at raising funds in the States than they are here. But actually the mixed model, which is public support, which leads to private support, and public support, which enables the greater taking of risks. I always think one of the functions of public money, whether it's money that goes into the BBC or via the Arts Council into an arts organisation, one of its functions is to enable greater creative risks to be taken, because today's outrage is tomorrow's mainstream. And so the mixed model, I think, is appealing, and I would certainly want to maintain it. And the other thing you have in the States is greater tax breaks. But actually, we have quite a range of tax breaks in this country, but we don't fully exploit them as well as we should. So, yes, you can learn from abroad, but I really would like to maintain the mixed model of both public and private funding.
Sir Peter Basil-Jett, thank you very much.
Not at all.